Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 54 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Hold On Tight, The World According to Peter Zion. But before I get to today's podcast, I want to encourage you to go back and listen to episode 53. Posted between Christmas and New Year's, you might have missed the episode owing to vacations or an altered work schedule, and you shouldn't. The podcast entitled Meet Derek Sanderson Policy Wonk includes within its 20 minutes all manner of challenges facing wheat farmers as seen through the eyes of the director of the Washington State Department of Agriculture. And now back to our original programming. Depending on the website you visit, Peter Zion is either a strategist on global affairs and geopolitics or a global energy demographic and security expert. He is the author of two books, The Accidental Superpower, The Next Generation of American Preeminence and the Coming Global Disorder, and The Absent Superpower, The Shale Revolution and the World Without America. A thinker and an author, Zion is also a wonderful speaker. He translated his ideas into a spellbinding hour-long presentation during the opening ceremony breakfast at the 2017 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention held in Spokane on November 10th. Zion mostly addresses agricultural issues indirectly. His forte is analyzing America's place in a volatile world through demographics, politics, and history. And all that impacts agriculture. As I was listening to Zion last November, I knew it wasn't going to be easy to edit his talk into a 20-minute podcast. So I didn't. This is one of two parts, and even then, I'm leaving out all of his commentary about how the U.S. shale revolution, which has led to a production boom in American-produced oil and gas, contributes to America's changing role in the world. I'm not sure I agree with everything Zion says, but I'll admit he has a knack for fitting together facts in interesting and not implausible designs. Zion's speech, which I've edited here, included a series of PowerPoint slides, but he speaks so well you won't miss them. He opened with a map of the United States, showing the country's river systems, with a tan area highlighting the fertile Midwest.
First, the good news. The tan area on this map, that's the greater Midwest system. That's the single largest chunk of arable land on the world. As important as it is, you folks in agriculture know that moving things from A to B is a bit of a bitch, so it's really the blue lines that matter. Those are the interconnected waterways of the American maritime system. Here in the United States, we have 18,000 miles of those waterways, 13,000 just in the Mississippi. Moving things from A to B on water is 1/12 the cost of doing it on land. And our system has more waterway than the rest of the planet put together. In addition, we've got ocean moats on either side, which means we are condemned to being the world's agricultural, financial, industrial, cultural, and military superpower. Decades of bipartisan effort has yet to screw this up. And we are not going to figure out how to do that in the next 5 years. Let's start at the beginning. Our world begins in New Hampshire. Who knew? You see, before World War II, the world was a series of sequestered, militarized imperial trade networks. You didn't link up with your neighbors, much less people on the other side of the war, on the other side of the world. Because if someone did throw a war, even if they were rude and didn't invite you, you could lose access to whatever it was that you thought you needed. You kept everything in-house. And if you saw something you wanted, you went out and you took it and you folded it into your own militarized system. These systems competed for everything. Those competitions turned into World War II, which brought the whole thing crashing down. And at the end of World War II, the Americans, the last ones standing, brought their allies together here at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and held a conference. What do you do at a conference? You bait people in with a beautiful location, maybe the promise of golf, and then you lock them into a room while some blowhard prattles on. We've all been there. At Bretton Woods, the United States laid out the new rules of the game. from now on, instead of everybody having a separate system, everything would be integrated. The U.S. military would patrol the global oceans for everyone. Trade would, for the first time, be free. The U.S. market would open to everybody so you could export your way back to wealth. It was integrated. It was total. It was American-controlled. We sponsored, subsidized the entire system, and for the first time, there really was a global system. There was just one catch. You had to pick sides. You heard that right. We bribed up an alliance to fight and win the Cold War, and it worked really well. Global GDP expanded by a factor of 10. The global population tripled. It has been the longest period of peace and prosperity in human history. But the plan had one flaw. We won. Well, crap, now what? Then President Bush Sr. put together a team, Brent Scowcroft, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, sent them off to figure out, what's Bretton Woods 2? How do we take this alliance, the greatest alliance in human history, and play it forward for another half century of engaged American preeminence? And we Americans were so impressed that we voted him out of office. And in the next 6 consecutive federal election contests, we decisively chose the candidate with 0 foreign expertise. The economic aspects of Bretton Woods, the idea that the United States is the market of first and last resort, the idea that the United States will patrol the global oceans free of charge for everyone, that continued on. That became our new normal. But the idea that there was some sort of strategic quid pro quo in exchange, that fell away. And so the world got weird. The Brazilians are giving our farmers a run for their money. The Chinese have overtaken us as the industrial hub. The Russians have shown that throwing your weight around on the international stage is no longer a purely American prerogative. Trump's got a point. A really good one. Strategically, Bretton Woods no longer works for us. But economically, it was never supposed to. We subsidized the alliance. The alliance gives us our security. That was the deal. Where does the United States fit in this brave new world without the rubric of the Cold War? Well, the short version is we don't. And that's okay. Remember, for the Americans, trade is not about trade. Trade is about security. And we never bet the farm, pun intended, on the global trade system. We are the least involved economy in the world. Last year, only 8.5% of GDP came from merchandise exports. About half of that's within NAFTA. So when you hear people like Donald Trump saying he wants to forcibly renegotiate every deal on the books, or folks like Secretary Clinton, who says she's opposed to every free trade deal that the United States has negotiated in the last 30 years, including those she personally negotiated, it's not rhetoric. It's the American political center coming to terms and groping its way forward from a trade policy, a security policy, that's 30 years out of date. Let's look at it by state. The deeper the color on this map, the more that state is involved in international commerce. Can you see the relationship between the colors on that map and the red-blue breakdown in American politics? Nobody? It's because there isn't one. There's no correlation whatsoever. We have no way to process how we interact with the world in the way we process politics locally, which means that the United States can maintain a globally devastating foreign and economic policy without any ripple of discussion here at home. What if we look at it politically? Now, the reason that the Republicans tend to win the big elections is that their coalition is more coherent. So the national security conservatives don't try to tell you what to do with your personal life. The pro-lifers don't want to shut down the Navy. Everybody has a short list of issues that they're passionate about. You can build those into a platform, take it to the polls. Everyone shows up and votes. It's reliable. They tend to win. That's not how it works with the Democrats. It's a broader coalition, but it's at each other's throats the whole time. So unions and Greens disagree on every aspect of industrial policy. The socialists, who think that college education should be free, disagree with the single mothers who would then have to pay higher taxes. Gays and blacks, radically different concept of what the term civil rights even means. Any Democratic candidate who tries to run on the issues sparks a fight. Hillary Clinton, Michael Dukakis, cannot win. But if the Democrats can float a candidate who can run on force of personality and paper over the policy differences of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, it's a broader coalition, it's got more numbers, they'll carry the day. And then in the middle, you've got two groups that are kind of squishy. They tend to be socially conservative, but also economically liberal, but really hard to pin down. Now, let me sum up an 8-hour presentation on American politics into 30 seconds. We've had social media. We've had the Bernie Sanders revolution. We've had the Orlando massacre. We've found out that Donald Trump has been in two softcore porn films. We've got the fact that Donald Trump was a registered Democrat and a pro-abortion advocate for 35 years. We have the unions going isolationist. We've got the fact that pollsters forgot to ask if the Hispanics they were polling were citizens and could vote. And we've had Catholics that just want to take a shower and forget the whole thing. And here's where we actually ended up. The two-party system that runs this country is currently offline. This is normal, healthy even. Politics shifts, demography evolves, technology evolves, the balance of power among the states moves. Politics moves with it, on a delay. Now, the last time both parties broke down at the same time, it was the 1930s. We had the Great Depression. We evolved into World War II. It took 12 years for the two parties to take the shape that we now recognize. Before that happened, the Republicans were actually the big government party. We'll get through this. It'll just take time. In the meantime, it really didn't matter who won the presidency, because whoever did wasn't going to have a party to rule with or a party to negotiate with. And so, we can't have a discussion about what we want out of our foreign affairs. And without that discussion, we can't have a goal. Without a goal, we can't have a policy. And so as far as the rest of the world is concerned, we're out. Let's look at it by demographic slice. So for people who were born before 1946, this is probably how you still think of the baby boomers. Those damn liberal hippies that just don't understand. Well, sorry, folks, but the boomers are starting to look a lot more like this these days. They're evolving into get-off-my-lawn conservatives. This is expected. You retire, you get a little crotchety. What about the millennials? The millennials, they were raised differently. Didn't keep track of the score at soccer games, went to university based on who had the coolest dorms, took an extended adolescence, only took jobs that fulfilled them. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that life stopped. It just was weird for a while. And now the older millennials turn 37 this year. And on average, they've got two kids. And because they've been switching jobs every 6 to 9 months, they don't have a lot of built-up income. And they're discovering you can't raise two kids in a midtown apartment on a barista salary. And they're having to move back to their hometown because they need the free childcare that comes from being close to the bank of mom and dad. They have all of the inputs of a midlife crisis without any of the accrued assets or experience that allow them to recover from a midlife crisis. The days of pooping and getting a trophy are long gone. And the world isn't turning out the way they thought. They're becoming angry and bitter, and 45% of them voted for Donald Trump. The two great liberal progressive generations in American history, the baby boomers and the millennials, are descending into narcissistic populism at the same time. And while for the boomers this is to a certain degree to be expected, it's an age issue. But the boomers will cease being a major factor in American elections sometime between 2030 and 2035, simple mortality. But the millennials, who are now establishing lifelong voting patterns, are starting to vote like people 2 and 3 times their age. And they will be the dominant voting bloc in American politics until 2070, which means that Donald Trump is likely to be the least populist, most internationalist, most inclusive president that the United States has in our lifetimes. And if you're a foreign leader and you cannot strike a deal with Trump now, it will not get any easier. Let's look at it more statistically. This is a demographic profile. You've got children at the bottom, young adults, mature adults, retirees at the top. Men on one side, women on the other. Simple mortality makes it a pyramid. This is India. This is what's called a consumption-led demographic, because people who are roughly age 20 to 45, the younger folks, young workers, it's all about the consumption. It's raising kids, buying cars, buying houses, smoking pot, spend. But they're new. Their incomes have not yet expanded to meet their needs. So it's house loans, college loans, car loans. It's high growth. That consumption is what drives modern systems, but also high debt. In India, because you have so many young people relative to mature workers, you can consume everything that you produce. You don't have to be part of a broader trading network. You can go it alone. Might not be the best idea, but you can make it work. You can't do that in South Korea. People roughly aged 40 to 65, it's all about the investment. They're not consuming a lot anymore. The house is paid for. The college is long gone. The kids hopefully have moved out and not come back. But you're saving for retirement. All that capital, you're at the height of your earning capacity, gets invested. This is also the tax base. But you have to be part of a broader system because you cannot possibly consume everything you produce because you've got productive workers in that upper tier and very few people down below to do the buying. And if you keep aging, you turn into Japan. Japan's in a weird spot because it has to produce goods without a workforce. There's a reason that Japan is the world's leader in automation, because the alternative is national destitution. Three different systems: consumption-led, investment-led, retirement-led. Here's the United States. We're in the middle. We have a chimney demography. Now, up at the top, there with the B, that's the baby boomers. Largest generation in American history in that capital-rich demographic. They have made the United States capital-rich. Unprecedentedly capital-rich. Exorbitantly capital-rich. Too capital-rich. Because all of that money chasing the same number of economic opportunities has pushed down the rate of return on capital. That's made it very hard for the boomers to earn investment returns. So they have been forced to push their money into ever more riskier assets in that mythical effort to reach that magical extra 1% of return before they retire. And this has pushed money into places that, in retrospect, probably weren't the best idea. This is the Brazil boom, the China boom, Enron, subprime, disco. None of this should have ever happened. And by the year 2022, when the majority of the boomers have moved into retirement, all of those investments get liquidated, the capital comes home and gets converted into T-bills and cash because they won't be able to take the volatility. The cost of capital will at least quadruple. Next generation down, that's Gen X, that's me. I'm part of the smallest birth year in American history, 1974. My generation's problem is one of, woohoo, yeah, we're both here. Yeah. My generation's problem is one of relative size to the generations above and below, which are much larger. Now, right now, that's working for us. All those baby boomers making all those investments pushed down the cost of borrowing. I've been able to refinance my house 5 times in the last 6 years. 2.04%. It's awesome. It's also temporary. By 2022, all that money goes away, and it is up to Gen X to supply capital for 75 million retiring baby boomers. And there's only 11 of us. Not 11 million, just 11. So we know that the marginal tax rate will go up by at least 50% unless the baby boomers choose to vote away their Social Security benefits and their Medicare and Medicare benefits, which I find highly unlikely. It's going to suck. And then you've got Gen Y, the millennials, those neurotic, narcissistic, omnipresent millennials. Now, while the millennials do deserve every shovelful of crap I send their way, thank God they're there. Three big reasons. First, consumption. They're in that prime consuming demographic right now. So all those bedazzled flip-flops and all those circulation constricting jeans and all of those fat-free, soy-free, dairy-free, gluten-free, fair trade beard butter canisters, they add up. Millennial consumption is what has kept the United States out of recession for 4 years now. And they're in that prime consuming demographic for about another 8. It does not make us recession proof, but it certainly helps. Second, by the year 2030, when the millennials have matured, and define that word however helps you sleep at night, they will fill out the tax paying class in a way that Gen X never could. So there is a light at the end of the fiscal tunnel, and it is not a train, it's just a millennial. Yay. Third, we all think of the millennials as being the end-all and the be-all, but they're really all alone in the night, because in the rest of the developed world, there was a baby bust that started around the year 1970. And if you factor the United States out of the 2030 demographic data for the rich world, it's almost over. The world's going to have all the economic dynamism of an old folks' home. So today, courtesy of the millennials, the United States is the top consuming power, and courtesy of the boomers, we're the top investment power. But by 2030, we're the only consumption power and only investment power. We are in the midst of the great transition. The United States is becoming the only country on the planet that can absorb global exports at the same time it has lost all political interest in doing so.
Well, that's a bit of a cliffhanger, isn't it? I hope you enjoyed the show and will join me again for episode 55, or part 2 of Hold On Tight, The World According to Peter Zion, a strategist on global affairs and geopolitics, or a global energy demographic and security expert. Either way, he's worth listening to on Weed All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.